You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a great conversation today. I'm talking to Jonah Berger, who is a marketing professor at the Wharton School. You might know him from his best-selling book, Contagious, and he's got a brand new book called The Catalyst, How to Change Anyone's Mind. Enjoy the talk.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Jonah Berger, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you start your new book, Catalyst, with the story of Greg Vecchi, a case agent. A case agent for the FBI who led a 3-year effort to capture a member of the Russian mob. And you set this very cinematic scene where the SWAT team is called in and Greg is doing this briefing. And at the end, the short balding guy is in the room and he asks Greg a question. Can you take us through the rest of that story?
Sure. Yeah. Greg is, by the way, is an amazing guy. And it was wonderful to interview him for this book. And he tells the story where, you know, he's a seasoned negotiator. He's having this briefing. You know, imagine a room filled with tall, stocky, buff SWAT team guys. They're going through the logistics of, like, you know, breaking the door down and finding this criminal that they've been tracking for years and, you know, figuring out how to get him out without him killing anybody or sort of trying to shoot them. And so it's all logistics and brute force and all these different things. And there's sort of this small bald guy in the corner who afterwards is sort of asking Greg, hey, you know, can you tell me a little bit about the guy? And Greg's like, what do you mean? Like, we just had this whole briefing. I told you he's dangerous. He's armed, all these other things. And the short balding guy is like, no. Like, you know, what's he like? And Greg's like, what do you mean? What's he like? Like, I just told you all these things. He's like, you know, does he have any pets? What's it? Well, tell me some stuff about him. And Greg's sitting there go, what do you mean? What does he have any pets? Like, why does that matter? And so they get to the day of, right? And everybody's ready to sort of kick down the door and knock things down, and, you know, bust down everything to get to this criminal. But they don't do it. Because someone's talking on the phone to him. And before they get to the moment where they go in and they bust down the door and everything else, the guy comes up with his hands up, walks out the door, but on his own accord, this sort of criminal is a terrible things, comes out with his hands up. And what Greg realizes is the guy, the small ball guy who's in the corner of the room that asked, you know, does he have any pets? That guy was the lead negotiator on this particular thing. And by understanding the guy, right, by understanding everything, including whether or not he has pets, the guy was able to get him to come out with his hands up. And so it's an amazing story. Greg's an amazing storyteller. I'm doing my best to relay it. But I think what's most interesting about it is the approach that Greg talks about, right? It's not about barreling down the door. It's not about pushing harder. It's not about sort of forcing someone to do something. It's about stepping back, about understanding what those barriers to change are and figuring out how to mitigate them.
We were talking before we got on the air here, and you've taken an improv class, and you claim you're not good at it. I don't know. We'd have to see. But one of the things that very beginners that we teach in improv is you need to start by listening and building trust. And that strikes me exactly the same thing that good hostage negotiators need to do, right?
Oh, exactly right. And sorry, before we start, I am bad at improv. I will tell you, I love it. I love it. I think it's very valuable, as we were talking about. I think everyone should take an improv class in their life. I think it should be a mandatory course, even at liberal arts colleges. It's a great life skill. That doesn't mean I'm good at it. I am terrible at it, but I enjoy it.
Okay.
But you know, starting with listening is really key. I talked to Greg at length, and he talks about, you know, novice negotiators, what they do is they come in and they start with influence. They start with the outcome they want to achieve, right? And they think, you know, come out with your hands up. If I just tell people what I want, they'll do it. And most of us are not hostage negotiators, but most of us deal with something very similar in our lives, right? We're trying to change someone's mind. If we're in marketing or sales, we're trying to change the customer or client's mind. If we're an employee, we're trying to change our boss's mind. If we're a leader, we're trying to change organizational culture. If we're a startup, we're trying to change an industry. If we're a nonprofit, we're trying to change the world. But change is really, really hard. And too often we go for that default. Well, what's the thing I want to achieve, right? What's the outcome I want to achieve without stepping back and saying, well, wait, why hasn't this person changed already? What's stopping them? And that's where I think that idea from improv is really, really key, right? If we don't understand the person we're trying to change, who they are, what's driving them, if we don't start with listening, if we don't start with understanding, it's going to be really hard to move people. Think about like a doctor, for example. You know, if you went into the doctor's office and the first thing the doctor said was, okay, let me put a cast on your leg, you'd say, well, hold on. What do you mean? You don't yet understand what my problem is, right? And the same thing is true with change. If we don't understand what the barriers are, if we don't understand why someone hasn't changed already, what things are getting in their way, it's going to be really hard to get them to change.
So you started studying this idea of catalysts because you yourself were kind of stuck, right?
Oh yeah, so I'm an academic at heart. So I've spent almost 15 years at the Wharton School, marketing professor, do lots of academic research. A number of years ago, I came out with a popular press book, sort of changed my life. Mm-hmm. It was called Contagious. Before that, I was only sort of a teacher and a researcher, but I started getting calls from all sorts of companies and organizations, everything from the Googles and the Nikes and the Apples of the world to small startups to help them get their products to catch on, to help them change behavior, drive action, and so on. And I realized at the core, they all had something they wanted to change, but pushing wasn't working. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, when we think about changing, if we're a boss, we think about making one more speech. If we're a salesperson, we think about making one more phone call. If we're an employee, we think about making one more presentation, even with our spouses, right? Even with our kids. Oh, if I just tell them why I feel the way I feel, they'll come around. And it's clear why we think pushing works, right? Pushing works really well for physical objects. If there's a chair in the middle of a room and I want to move that chair, pushing is a great way to move that chair. I push it, it goes. When we push people, though, they don't just go, right? Mm-hmm. Because people aren't chairs. When we push people, they dig in their heels, they push back. They often do the exact opposite of what we want them to do. And so that's really where we have to start with understanding, where we have to identify those barriers, figure out why people haven't changed. And only then, once we've mitigated those barriers, can we really drive action.
So this is, I mean, it's a terrific book, and it, you've got the evidence, but you also have these amazing characters and case studies. I want to talk a little bit about loss aversion, which we've talked about on the podcast before, but in particular, a story that you tell. I want to relate to you something that happened to me, and then we can tie it back to the book, but a couple of years ago, I woke up and my face was just all like covered in, I don't know, it looked like dark splotches. And I'm like, what has happened? And so I go to like the Walgreens. And they're like, no, you need to go to a real doctor. And so I go to this other clinic. And the woman's like, anyone ever told you have a heart murmur? And I'm like, no. This led me on this journey where I figure out that I've got this heart condition. And it's not, you know, it's fine. It's most people are trifurcated coming out of their heart. I'm bifurcated. So I'll have to get my heart repaired. But what I did almost, I don't know, within a couple of weeks. And I had tried exercise and losing weight and eating better and that, and I just never stuck. But with this like major condition, I completely transformed my life health-wise. So, you know, I've lost like 30 pounds, my cholesterol is down, like all this stuff. And like, just, I never would have done that before. So you kind of talk about a similar thing in the book.
So first of all, I hope everything is okay with your heart, and I hope it goes well. But second of all, I'll relate it to this story in the book. You know, there's a great psychology study where they ask people, which do you think causes more pain? A major injury, you shatter your kneecap, something happens to your spine, you break your elbow, something really bad, a heart attack, something really bad, or a minor injury, you know, like every time you play basketball, you get a little tinge in your shoulder, mm-hmm. you know, your ankle, you have a little bit of a trick knee, something along those lines. And not surprisingly, most people say, well, of course, a major injury hurts a lot more, right? It's a lot more impactful. It's a lot of pain. These minor injuries don't cause very much pain. And that makes a lot of sense, but it's wrong. And the reason why is because if we have a major injury, we get it fixed, right? As you just very nicely said, right? We change our life. We go to the doctor. We get surgery. We engage in physical therapy. We lose weight. We start taking medication. But if we have a minor injury, we tend just to say, oh, you know, I'll deal with it next week. Oh, it'll go away. And so at each period, at the first period, the major injury hurts a lot more. But the minor injury never goes away. And so over time, it ends up causing us a lot more pain overall. And I think this is a nice example of, as you sort of alluded to, this notion of a status quo bias. Mm-hmm. We have a tendency to stick with doing things we've done in the past. We buy the same products. We use the same services. If at an organization, for example, you know, companies tend to stick with programs or initiatives they've run in the past, even if they're not completely working, be very wary of starting new projects and new initiatives, even if they look quite promising, because stuff we know feels safer, right? I know this thing, even if it's not perfect, at least I know it, where new things are sort of scary. There's uncertainty, there's fear, there's anxiety. I'm not sure it's going to work out. And so one key then way to get people to change, one thing we have to do is we have to ease endowment. We have to ease this attachment to the old thing. And the problem, right, is if the old thing was terrible, people would have already changed.
Right.
But if the old thing was a broken kneecap, if the old thing was a house infested with cockroaches, right, people are going to make the phone call to get the exterminator to come if your house is infested with cockroaches. What if you just have a couple flies? What if it's not terrible, right? It's not worth calling the exterminator, but then it lasts forever, like that minor injury. And so what we need to think about doing is highlighting the cost of inaction. We have to make people realize that, yes, that minor thing, yes, the thing you're doing now isn't terrible, but it's also on the long term going to be really, really painful. I was talking to a cousin of mine, and every time he wrote his email, at the bottom of his email, would write "Best Charles." Every time in the email, type in "Best Charles," including on his phone. And I was like, well, why don't you include that in your email signature? And he was like, oh, I don't exactly know how to use signatures. And I mean, it doesn't take me that long anyway, right? It only takes a couple seconds to write this note at the bottom of my email. And so every time I'd see him, I'd sort of, you know, make jokes and sort of push him. He should change. He never did. And then finally, I took a different approach. I said, well, hey, you know, how many emails do you write a week? And he thought about it and was like, I don't know, maybe I write 70 a day. So I don't know, maybe 400, something like that a week. And I was like, okay, how much time does it take you to write each of those emails, the little signature on the bottom? And he went, I don't know, maybe 5 or 10 seconds. And I said, okay, well then how much time do you spend every week writing those email signatures? And he thought about it for a second. And then he went to Google and typed in, you know, how do you automate your email signature? Because yes, at each point in time, it's easier to stick with what we're doing in the past, right? It's easier to keep eating the junk food. It's easier to, you know, not go to the doctor about a minor injury. It's easier to stick with the status quo. It is cheaper. The status quo is easier to stick with, but it's often in the long term very costly. And so we have to figure out how to highlight those costs of an action, make them realize that doing nothing isn't as safe or as riskless as people might feel. And by doing that, encourage them to come around and change.
So that's one way to do it. You have another way to do it that's far more dramatic, which you refer to as burning the ships. I mean,
yes. Yes. And so I'll tell you the true meaning of burning the ships, and then we can talk about a variant. So the true meaning of burning the ships basically comes from kind of, I'll call it olden times, because I can't remember the exact year. But basically, there was this explorer who's exploring parts of Central and South America, and his crew is sort of basically saying, "Look, we want to go home. This expedition isn't everything we dreamed it would be. We're not finding all the gold we hoped." And he's got to get them to sort of keep trudging on, even though they're not happy with him. Mm-hmm. And so what he does is he ends up burning the ships. He ends up taking his own ships that he used to get there from, I think it was the Dominican Republic or something, and burning them to not the ground, the water, I guess it might be. And everyone sat there going, "Oh my God, you're burning the ships." But then because they can't get home, they got to trudge inland and go with the rest of the mission, right? If there's no other option, you basically take the status quo off the table. And it's possible to do that, right? We can take the status quo off the table, but there's also milder versions of that. Mm-hmm. I tell the story in the book of someone who's in IT, and folks in IT, bless their hearts, they have to deal with all the challenging folks like myself who do lots of things and think IT is very easy, but ends up screwing around with everything and messing things up. But people don't want to update their software. Right. People don't want to get new computers if they're working just fine. Whereas the folks on the IT side are probably saying, "Oh, there's all these security risks, all these different things." And so there was someone who worked in IT that was trying to get people to change, update their systems, get new computers. People didn't want to do it. And so finally they sent a note out saying, "Hey, we recognize that you might not want to switch. No problem. You don't have to. But if you don't want to upgrade to the newest systems, it's a security risk. And so we're no longer going to be able to help you with your complaints." Right? Not that we don't want to help you. We're just not going to have the skills to, deal with a version of Office that's 7 years old or, a laptop that's way out of the service warranty. We're not going to have the skills to help you. And so we can't deal with it anymore. Notice they're not completely burning the ships, right? The ships are still there. You can still use your old computer, but they're basically raising the cost of sticking with the old thing. And that was super helpful, right? A whole bunch of people emailed him saying, "Hey, come check it out, update my stuff." Because once now I'm going to have to deal with it myself, I might as well go around and change it. Makes me realize the costs of inaction aren't as low as I might have thought.
So this made me think about the sort of, Second City's been around for 61 years and been very successful, but we buck a lot of the rules of theater. So, first of all, there's a rule of like, you never close a hit show, and we always create new shows. You want to hold on to talent. We let talent leave. And what I realize is we kind of are burning the ships to stay creative. By forcing out, we have really great people, they stay for a few years, then they go to Saturday Night Live or somewhere else, but that allows another space for another voice to come forward, and it forces us into sort of originality as opposed to complacency. So I think there's a little bit of that in the design of our theater.
Yeah. And I mean, even think about that from a talent standpoint. So I completely agree with you, by the way. I think it fosters creativity, it fosters change, it fosters new ideas, which is great. But it also encourages people as they're thinking about joining you to say, "Well, look at all these people that have gone on and do all these other things. Maybe I should come here as well." Whereas if you held on to them, maybe they wouldn't necessarily be as successful later because they wouldn't have taken the plunge and failed for 2 years, but eventually been quite successful. Consulting companies actually do something a little bit similar, where they really encourage people once they've been at a firm for a number of years to go to business school or to branch out and do something else. They'll even give you sort of 6 months off where they say, go pursue your passion and see how it goes, for a couple reasons. One, they want new people to come up in the firm. But two, they recognize if you step out of the firm, you go to business school, you meet more people, you start a new company, well, now you might be a client of the consulting firm in the future. And so I certainly think there's value, even though it feels scary, right? It does to burn those ships. It can actually have some nice benefits.
So I'm married to a comedy professor, and she has among her theories of comedy, one is that you're dealing with these different levers, and they're primarily pain, recognition, and distance. And the distance part, and you talk about distance in the book quite a bit, but the connection I was sort of finding is in the comedy world, distance can sometimes be physical, which is like, a joke plays in the South where it won't play in the North. It can also be time. Can we make fun of or do jokes around 9/11 now? We couldn't right after 9/11, and it took a certain period of time. But you write about the importance of distance in a really bunch of interesting ways, as a way to change, get people to change.
Yeah. So I'll tell you about a study and then I'll sort of relate it to what we're talking about. It was a study that was done essentially with comedy recordings, basically. So they bring some students into the lab. They ask them to listen to some comedy recordings. And then they ask the students, okay, how funny was it? Right? Was this funny or not? And I think, you know, all of us who don't have the background in comedy that you and your wife have sort of think, oh, you know, humor is this thing. It's unique to each of us. How could someone study humor? But it's very possible. And these researchers are studying humor. And they did something interesting, though. In addition to sort of having a tape with some jokes on it, they manipulated whether other people were laughing at the joke. So the common way to call this is a laugh track, right? If you think about a sitcom, you know, you think about Seinfeld, for example, you know, someone makes a joke and it's not just that there's air after that. There's the audience going, ha, 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 right? And they do that in a sense to encourage you, the audience member, to laugh, right? If you hear other people laughing, it's a cue to go, oh, well, maybe that was funnier than I thought. Or, huh, maybe I'm not even thinking about whether it's funny or not. Other people are laughing, so I should be laughing too. It must be funny. And indeed, not surprisingly, that's what the study found, right? When other people are laughing, there's a laugh track attached to these jokes, essentially. Listeners find the jokes funnier. But that wasn't the only thing they did. They also did something quite interesting, which is they changed the nature of the audience. So the actual people laughing are the same. It's you're listening to it. You can't tell who the people are. But they either tell the participants that are students at some university that the people listening and thus laughing are basically other students like them, similar to you, are laughing like you, or people that are very different from you, sort of a group that's outside the university that students may even potentially not want to necessarily associate with. And what's interesting is the sound is the same, right? You're just hearing people laugh. You have no idea who these people are, but knowing who they are and having a sense that they're similar to you versus different from you changes how funny you find the jokes, right? If you think they're similar to you and they're laughing, you find the jokes really funny. And if you think they're different from you and they're laughing, you don't find them as funny because we use others as a signal of information. Right? When we're trying to figure out whether a joke is funny, whether we should watch a television show, whether we should engage in an action, we use others as a signal of whether we're going to like it or not. But there's always what's called a translation problem. Mm-hmm. Sure, people are laughing, but am I going to find it funny? Sure, you like a certain television show, but am I going to like it as well? And if the person's similar to you, it provides more relevant information. In a sense, it provides more evidence or more proof. I think a good analogy, you know, every time we're trying to change someone, they're sort of caught in a balance, right? They're doing something already, and you're trying to sort of put some more proof on their scale to tip them in the other direction. The more similar others are to oneself, the more similar the information is to someone you're trying to change, the more interested they'll be in changing because it provides more evidence that they themselves will like it. People like me laughed? Oh, I'll probably find it funny. Someone who has the same preferences in restaurants as me likes this restaurant, I'll probably like it as well. And so it's not just others, it's the similarity of those others. And I'll add one more detail, which is also about the number of others, right? Sometimes when we're trying to change minds, we think we can just add enough proof or enough evidence by ourselves. If I just give people more evidence, if I just tell people a little bit more, they'll come around. But the problem, right, coming back to that translation problem idea, is if it just comes from us, eventually someone goes, I get it. You like this show. I get it. You find this joke is funny. You like this restaurant. But I'm still not sure I'm going to like it. And if one person likes something, that's some information, but it's not enough, right? If one person says you have a tail, you laugh at them. Right? But if five people say you have a tail, well, you go, it's probably unlikely, but let me turn around and take a look, right? Because if five people are saying the same thing, suddenly it becomes much more likely. There's much more proof. And the same thing here, right? Similar others provide more proof than dissimilar others, but sometimes you need multiple others to provide enough proof to drive action.
Yeah. And I think that strikes me because I was thinking, like, how is this different when everyone's in a comedy club and they're seeing sort of each other laugh? And I think that last point is what's going on there. Right. I mean, it's much easier and powerful to share laughter. It's also, you know, synchronous, which is also kind of an amazing response because you don't get that in other forms of entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a team sport in some sense, right? Yeah. Like you're all sitting there and laughing is what your team is doing. And so, or not laughing, right? I mean, you know, again, I'm terrible at improv, but I've done a very little bit of improv and enough public speaking to know that when you're standing up there and the audience isn't into it, right? Other audience people get not into it because they go, well, other people don't look like they're engaged. If people are asking questions, I'll ask a question. If people aren't asking questions, I won't ask a question. And so people are often looking to others for signals of what they should do.
So I want to talk a little bit about how one mitigates distance in terms of this. So how do you take care of this distance problem in dealing with this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you're trying to change others, I often say, you know, the best salespeople are not salespeople, they're existing customers, right? Mm-hmm. You're trying to sell people something, don't tell them how much you like it, particularly if it's coming from you, because people say, well, of course you like this, right? Mm-hmm. If you're a salesperson selling a product, if you're a marketer that works for a company, of course the company says that they're great. No one says that their company is terrible, but why don't you have people talk to some existing customers? Right? Because existing customers are going to be much more diagnostic because they don't work for the organization. And particularly if you pick the right ones, you pick similar others that are in a similar vertical or industry, you know, provides much, much more proof. Same thing within an organization. If I'm trying to get people to do something, don't just say, hey, you should do this thing, or hey, you know, I like this thing, so I think you should do it. Well, of course, you like it. It's your project. It's your proposal. It's your initiative. Instead, encourage people to talk to someone else who's not you. Right? Go talk to some other people, see what they think about it, right? Picking the right others who've engaged with something like this in the past can be a really powerful source of proof.
We have an improv exercise, and we've been doing this virtually. It actually works nicely, and it's for a variety of reasons, but we have people interview, have two people interview each other, and the job is when they come back to the group to tell the other person's story.
Yeah.
And it's a really lovely way both of getting someone to pay attention to details, figure out what details are important, but it also creates this like really kind of interesting bond of trust just by having someone tell another person's story.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. And I think the importance of listening there is also quite interesting, right? It forces you to listen to someone because you know you're going to have to say it later. And it's also interesting, I think, as a speaker, to become more familiar with what people remember about what you say. You know, I think everyone, myself included, is really bad at this, right? We think a lot about, you know, our ideas and our perceptions. We think a lot less about what other people remember or share about what we say, because we're really not good at putting ourselves in other shoes. But an exercise like that forces us to go, huh, like someone interacted with me for 5 or 10 minutes. This is what they took away. Is that what I wanted them to take away? And if not, how can I communicate better to encourage them to take away the things I want them to?
Yeah, this made me think too of the exercise we created at the Second Science Project, our collaboration with the University of Chicago, where we had first done the yes and exercise for the sort of academic crew up there. And they're like, okay, this makes sense. We understand the evidence behind why this might work, especially in sort of the nudge aspect of their stuff. But the question was, so what are the magic words for when you're in an intractable conversation where, you know, you disagree about, you know, guns or abortion or these areas where just you can't find any common ground. And after some work, both on the improv side and then on the academic research side, we came up with this vertical thank you because, where you first thank the person for whatever information they shared, which sets off the gratitude part of the brain. And then the because is crucial. You find some point of agreement, even if it's just the passion that this person brings with it. And we've been doing studies on this, and we find that people stay in these conversations longer using that technique.
Yeah. You know, it sounds first of all, it sounds super interesting, but it also sounds a little bit related to something I talk about in the book, which is the notion of an unsticking point.
Yeah.
Right? You know, too often in these intractable conversations, we focus on our differences, mm-hmm. Which makes it really hard to connect. But if we start by focusing on an unsticking point, a place where we do agree, you know, there's a great Heineken commercial that does a version of this where they, you know, take people who should disagree. So, you know, a feminist and someone who sort of hates women, someone who's transgender and someone who says they hate transgender people. And rather than have them start talking about what they disagree with, they have them go through this exercise of basically kind of building a bar. And then afterwards, they sort of share with each other the fact that they disagree. And then they ask them, okay, do you want to have a beer with this person or not? And what's great about it is if you start where you disagree, well, of course you don't want to share a beer with this person because all you know is that you disagree. But if you start with where you agree, you start with that common ground, you start with an unsticking point where you're not so far away. Now it's much more like, wow, this is a real person. I know and understand them. I'm going to be more likely to listen to where they're coming from for the rest of the interaction.
Oh, I love that. I mean, this is so relevant to, of course, darkly so, to the world we live in right now. I'm just curious, you handed in the manuscript before COVID and all this?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the book came out actually right at the beginning of COVID, which is obviously a great time to release the book. But, you know, yeah. I handed in the manuscript for this a while ago at this point. It takes a long time through the publishing process. Yeah.
So what I mean, I'm sort of curious. So what, because I read it as sort of deeply relevant to right now, not wrongly relevant at all. Is there stuff now that you would have changed or focused on differently?
I mean, I think there are some things. First of all, COVID is just a great example, but some of it is it's a great example of the principles. You know, I talk about the notion of reactance, where if you tell people to do something, they're less likely to do it. And I don't know about you, but yeah, right, exactly. So, you know, you have, I think, a set of people that if you had asked them, hey, you know, do you want to wear a mask or not? Do you think this is a good idea? They probably would have actually said yes.
Yeah.
But because the government said, you need to wear a mask or else, they said, don't tell me what to do. Don't tread on my civil liberties. I'm going to do whatever I want, including getting COVID by not wearing a mask. And it wasn't even like they wanted not to wear a mask. It was because you pushed them that they pushed back. And so I tell a version of this in the book about Tide Pods. You know, remember the Tide Pod challenge where people start eating Tide Pods in part because Tide told them not to, right? But if it was COVID, I would have talked about that as well. I wrote a piece in the Harvard Business Review soon after COVID started happening, sort of relating some points in the book to it. But it's certainly a very relevant and interesting time to think about behavior change.
Well, and I'm sure, I'm guessing, but I imagine at, you know, Penn, you know, that people are wearing masks and they're wearing masks in Old Town in Chicago, and you know, and then I'll drive to other parts. I've been doing this challenge with my son where we go and find the best Italian beefs in Chicago, which is then taking us out to places that have tons of Trump signs, and there's like no one wearing masks there.
Yeah, and I think there's a few reasons, right? So one, it's what we just talked about, but it's also the laughter study.
Yes, right.
You know, like if you look around and no one's laughing, you don't laugh. If you look around and no one's wearing a mask, you don't wear one. And so, you know, part of this is it's easier not to wear a mask than wear one. And, you know, it's very public and very visible. But if on day one, you know, other people in your community aren't doing it or are sort of uncertain about doing it, and people are telling you what to do, you sort of say, I'm not going to wear one. And then it's hard to get going around it, because now it means something different, right? You know, it's not just a health decision. It's a signal of self. You know, Trump has made it not masculine somehow, in some weird way. It's not masculine to wear a mask. And so maybe some people would have worn one and go, oh, well, you know, I don't want to wear it because I don't want to look not masculine.
Right. All right. The way we end the podcast every week is we ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they get really nowhere by saying no. And they actually don't get that far by saying yes. We say you have to say yes and, you have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Yeah, I don't think I have an amazing one, but I'll tell a brief one. You know, when I started working with companies and organizations, I felt like I had a sweet spot. As an academic, you know, your currency, whether you're good at your job or not, is whether you can create new ideas. But that's very different, actually, than being a consultant, which is, as a consultant, you don't need to create new ideas. You just need to help companies apply the right ideas. And so originally, some companies would reach out and ask me to do things that were very much within my wheelhouse. And I would say yes, easily. But then I started getting some calls that were a little bit outside my wheelhouse. And my tendency was to say no, right? No, I can't do this. No, I don't know enough about this. No, maybe it's not going to be a great idea. But what I realized is if it was close enough, not only would it be something I think I could deliver some value on, but I could also potentially learn from it. And so I tried to start saying yes, but I often added some ands in there. And here's a way or direction I think we could take it to make it even better. And I think it's turned out okay. So, you know, you never know what you're going to find when you say yes, but often you learn a lot along the way.
I love that. Yeah, I mean, we're all guilty of it. You can have all this knowledge. It does not matter. In everyday decisions, we're doing this stuff over and over and over again. And it's hard to catch. It's hard to catch yourself. So you have to create very, you know, for me, it's sort of like I'm steeped in yes and, but, you know, I'll find myself saying no. You know, like, I'm the yes and guy. I say no all the time. So you really do have to sort of, to be successful with this stuff, is really design your days to help you not fall into these patterns.
Yeah, but even take your example about, like, driving around Chicago to find the best sandwich.
Yeah.
Right? That's a great way of designing your experience to encourage yourself to learn about new things and have new experiences. And so I think, we have to be mindful, not just of changing our own behavior, but as you said, designing the world around us to help us get where we want to go.
The book is called The Catalyst, How to Change Anyone's Mind. Jonah Berger, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.